Okay, so this is the last one of the book, and then I've actually got to finish this book, which is hard for me because I always tend to not quite finish things. I have to really beat myself up to get it done. Got to give a shout out to Jake Hebb. He is my niece's fella and a decent dude, and he's given me a little message that said, what am I going to do now on the weekend? That little moment where I escape. All right, Jake, you've shamed me into it. I'm going to try and just open my journal itself, my old journal, and try and dig out some information from there. See how I go. Jeez, the frogs are out tonight. So this is where we left off last time. Meeting the Palangi guy at the reef, going back to Waleva. And then I go back in time a bit, checking out some other stuff from my journal. And then we go forward again. Hope it makes sense. I've been waiting on the edge of the island, waiting for the tide to drop. This Palangi kid showed up called Ross. I've warned him about the reef, and he's like, oh shit, there's another Palangi here. I'm not Robinson Crusoe. Go away. Go and stand behind that bush so I can feel like I'm more intrepid. Paul and William showed up, impressive looking on their horses. They smiled as Ross slipped around in his sandals trying to get across the reef. Paul reached down, offering a strong arm, and pulled him onto his horse. Ross climbed up and immediately slipped over the other side of the horse's back into the water. After a couple of drinking nuts on the islands, William and Paul made off on their fishing trip. I watched them leave, admiring how in tune they were with their environment. Will ran and jumped up on his horse, the whites of his feet dazzling in sunlight in contrast to his ebony skin. Ross marched on to Sonny's place, his freckled skin lobstering in the heat. This is a bit out of my journal, a bit of extra information about when I came back from Tofua with the Tongan guys. So the next morning, I woke up glad to be back, staring out at Cowan Tofua on the horizon. It's a spring tide, so it looks like I'm stuck here for the day. The water wasn't going to be shallow enough. First job was to gut and cook the fish before the insects demolished it. I cooked it straight on the coals and had a fair job of eating it, considering it was big enough to feed four people. But no refrigeration, no skills to dry it and preserve it, so I just had to eat this entire fish. I was back up the coconut tree, five coconuts. I opened three with a sharp stick and made a sweet porridge with the milk of two. I have to admit, the young milk is the best. Much more life in it. It's like carbonated. So it's like a fizz. Soda Stream for the Polynesians. And I've said here, I think I solved one of the Tongan lifestyle riddles today. The guy who was on Tofua, who berated the Tongans for being what he considered childish, laughing and joking. So these guys giggling like immature kids. And as I looked at him, stiff and smileless, he is the definition of maturity. Is he? Is he the definition of maturity? And I've written here, keep laughing, keep smiling, keep young. It's key, isn't it? You've got to be a bit daft. Just going to read a bit more out of this journal. This is on the island. I could do it like Robinson Crusoe. I was stranded today as the unrelenting rain came down. I managed to get a fire going. Okay. This is the 11th of July, 1997. I was stranded today as the unrelenting rain came down. I managed to get a fire going to cook some rice after searching the undergrowth for dry wood. The crabs were funny this morning, all pop-up eyes. They tried to stand still and avoid detection, but it was hopeless. They stood out a mile. I finally finished Edmund Hillary's book, Nothing Venture, Nothing Win. Crap title. Good meaning, but... Sorry, Edmund. Oh, please don't posthumously come down and get me. I loved your book, man. And Edmund Hillary was a beekeeper in New Zealand. So just remember, guys and girls, honey, keep up with that honey. You could be climbing mountains. Edmund Hillary makes my travel stories seem like a walk in the park. His book had been a lifesaver, actually providing good tinder at critical moments and providing entertainment as well. It's a way to escape, a way to leave this island mentally and come back. I've written here as well, when I went into town on the Sundays, walking tranquil, desert streets, the occasional chorus of singing emanating from one of a dozen churches, the breeze blowing through the church toward me, smelling a well-washed perfume, Sunday best bodies. And I've had a yarn with this guy called Palangi Pete and his wife, Merida. And we had a game of table tennis, which is illegal because you're not meant to do any sports on Sunday. It's so serious in Tonga that they've bent the dateline around Samoa so they can both play rugby together on the Saturday. So that... You have a look at the dateline. It bends around. Tuesday, a lazy day, spent feeding the pigs coconuts, which seemed only fair as I'd contribute to scoffing one last week. I was reading Wilbur Smith's River God. 10 out of 10 it was. And I was climbing very tall palm trees. The island's lost its charm now. With what happened with Sunny and Lavasi. Okay, I'm feeling the vibe, I need to leave. Like I'm not really welcome. I decide to walk around the entire island. Walk along the windward side, which is littered with 20th century disposables. It's got an eerie quietness to it, bar the rustle of the palm leaves. I see a sea snake, which was hiding in a hole in a rock, inches away from my feet. Back at base, a midnight raider. Probably a fruit bat scoffed half my tomatoes. Feels like a good time to leave now. Tomorrow being my last full day on the island, maybe I'll catch a fish. I think it's true to say to go back to a place can take away what it once was. I felt like I shouldn't have come back to Woolever. I should have just gone before Sunny cracked shits and Lavasi did this you and me business. And it all went a bit pear-shaped. I would have just been left with nice rose-tinted memories. I packed up my gear. Apart from the flattened sand and the hermits, it was as if I'd never been there. I finally left Woolever. Over the reef barefoot for the last time in my life. A watchful eye out for stonefish and sharp coral. I call in at Will's place for a wash. He gives me a necklace to send to my sister, made by his mum from tree bark. He was laid in his little Farley when I went past, like a woven palm shack out the back where when you reach puberty, you've got to leave the main house. And he's in his little special place out the back. He's got a ghetto blaster plane that some relatives sent him from overseas. I put down my bags and rummaged round for something I could give him, but I hardly had anything with me. I gave him Gordon's sunglasses, but that didn't really mean much because I didn't really need them. So I gave him my snorkel and mask. Will went into the main house where after 13 years, he was now banished from sleeping. He had to sleep in his folly that they'd make for him out in the backyard. He hung my presents on his mum's wall with a rake of other Western crap. Will opened me another coconut, seeing as I was mad for him, with two definite swipes of his knife. Alua, William called after me as I headed off. Nofua, I said in a quiet voice, in case I said it wrong. I made the wharf in time for the weekly ferry back to Tongatapu. Lavasi and his uncle were studying the wharf. I thought Lavasi might be pretty sheepish this morning, but he was totally the opposite. I think it was just a complete piss take on me and I'd gone for it. But they were cracking up, laughing, joking about winding me up the night before. I was totally confused. And I was unhappy that I had to leave on a bad note. I shook Lavasi's hand and thanked him for showing me the island. The bananas and the fish, and his auntie and the pig. But the you and me bit, even if it was a joke, put a damper on things. When I got back to Nukualofa in Tongatapu, that's the main town, and wandered out of the wharf, looking back at the ferry with all the people fighting to get on, carrying huge boxes and bags, I was relieved to be off it. Definitely it wasn't 100% seaworthy, that ferry. A lot of these ferries in poorer countries, they're like the old ferries from the modern countries. They just get sort of demoted and passed on, like hand-me-downs. It felt good to have a place to go back to, a place where I had a few friends. That night I sat out in the bush burning off leaves and scrub from the wind-felled trees at Naomi's place. That night when I went into the Blue Oyster Bar, it was a bit early and a young lady came out from behind the curtain that led into Frank's room. Later on, Frank showed up. It's all I can get these days, a fox. You either marry or you get a gold digger. And no one wants to marry an old fossil like me. There ain't no gold, sir. This leaves a fox. The glint in his eye changed my opinion there and then of poor old Frank. He's a dirty old man. Oh, remember Pacella and Steve, his brother? The Street Fighter! Well, he did actually do that humor for me. He stuck to the word and one day I was walking down the road in Tongatapu and this white van pulled up and the side door slid open. I thought, shit, am I going to get kidnapped here? But then there's Pacella and he pulls out this suckling pig. We cook you for your age on the umu, come on. And I had to just get in this van and start eating a pig with him at the side of the road. Bloody legend, guys. Like, there's a lot of mixture up there in Tonga, like, because you've got low monies up there from, you know, wages. There's not much resource up there. But rich in foods, as I said, and rich in culture and friendship. And I think maybe that's why the money just puts a stick in the forks. Like, it just fucks everything up because kind of warps it. Would have been perfect balance before. And apparently when some Europeans first got there, one guy said it was disturbing how the locals are so relaxed and don't seem to have an urgency about them. As in, Westerners battling to survive, having to make shelters and hunt for food. Everything was really hard for them. And then the Polynesians have got more of nature's wealth there for them, easier to get. So there's much less urgency to have, you know, mass shelters and storage of food over winter and everything else, because you've just got this bounty that's just replenishing all the time. I've written here that on the Friday night, I decided to have a few beers and go out clubbing in Tongatapu. And it's just a mind spin place. Like, if I've written, if you're an insensitive old crag of a bloke with lots of money, you can buy a new life. If you're a young, decent bloke looking for something special, it's all a dream. I asked Britta if she could lend me a couple of $100, and now I was killing time wandering around town in the islands, jogging along the beaches, past my friends at the poor village in the dump, sometimes swimming between the small islands and running around them. Anything to keep my mind straight. I returned home exhausted and content, because I hadn't had a girlfriend since Australia. And, I was going through a bit, I think, at 28. But I was just trying to stay out of trouble here and doing pretty well. Cooler nights were helping, douse my flames. I was 28, for God's sake, single. I fell into this situation, came in the shape of a beautiful Tongan lady, a bit older than me. But I found her looks and mannerisms mesmerizing. Her hair was a thick mass of black, tied back in a ponytail with curls falling down onto her face. She looked at me through soft brown eyes. Her hands were tanned and slim but strong from working the land. Frank played the host and we all sat round a table talking soberly. This beautiful lady, she was married to a Palangi guy, and he was there. But the more she drank, the more her leg seemed to slide under the table, and she started playing footsie with me under the table and giving me these like alluring looks. Luckily, long story there, but it worked out well in the end. I didn't give in to temptation. I went to the bathroom to cool down, ran my hands under the cool water, and woke myself up. I still had the scar on my nose where a jealous Palangi from a couple of nights ago had woken up at a table after his girlfriend had walked over to me, actually his wife had walked over to me, put her arm on my shoulder, and she was trying to fix me up with a friend. But he thought that I was trying to chat his wife up, which I was doing nothing. And he swung a lazy punch with a big wedding ring on, and it scuffed right up my nose. It's just like, idiot. So I got this big scar, not feeling my best. I've still got shit clothes. And this lady's playing footsie with me. And I go to the bathroom to look in the mirror, but someone's punched it out. While I was waiting to biding time to leave on my flight back to New Zealand and Australia, the backpackers got broken into. My tent went missing, my camera, Walkman, toothpaste. So we're looking for a nomadic dancing photographer with a dazzling smile. There's sort of written this journal, and there's lots of like drunk Palangis doing shameful things, and then there's locals who are trying to maintain their reputation, and I'm sort of understanding the importance of good reputation on the coconut wireless, which travels faster than any kind of internet. Naomi was drunk this last night. It's actually the first time I'd seen her that way. Do I play cards again or go and get laid? She played out a quick hand and stole off to meet her lover. So that was me on the last few days of Tonga, just trying to avoid getting married or meeting a fox. Yeah. It's crazy times. It's like not reality. Ironically, it was taxi man who drove me to the airport, telling me about his life on the streets in New Zealand and how he was in prison in Australia after his episode kidnapping the girl. Didn't seem to give a shit about telling me. When I reached New Zealand, my bubble was already burst. I sat in the cold waiting for a bus, looking at a picture of whatever that was already history, stuck in my journal. The riddle. The riddle of the missing money in the bar was solved months later when Frank accused taxi man of dipping the till of the $200 that went missing in a desperate bid to save his own ass. Taxi man hit the roof and screamed that Frank had paid him the $200 to sleep with his wife, with taxi man's wife. And taxi man was going ballistic, smashing up tables and chairs and threatening to kill Frank, who was hiding behind his customers. Taxi man raced off in his taxi and returned minutes later with his wife. He dragged her inside to where everyone was sitting and told her to admit what had happened. She wouldn't, so he stripped her naked in front of the whole bar. Fucking crazy. His wife broke down, totally humiliated and crying, admitting that she had actually slept with Frank for money. There's no turning back for Frank. He had severely betrayed the trust and kindness of Naomi, and his greed and his lust for women. And now he'd lost his kingdom and the sanctuary of his little bush bar, away from the mosquitoes. Yeah, Frank, you dickhead. Yeah, so when people tell you there's a story, there's something else always behind it, right? But yeah, it was... If I was to stay there, I would have either been duped by a fox, been with a married woman, and probably got punched out, or have to marry someone. And all those options weren't that appealing to me then at 28. I had a pretty big mission ahead. I had to get through New Zealand immigration and then get through Australian immigration without any financial status to back me up. Naomi lent me the $200 like she promised. She didn't even know my full name. My word was all she needed. I made the gates into New Zealand, where I already had a return ticket to Australia. Grant and his wife, from the Kiwis, he put me up in their bus until it was time to fly. Grant was much better now, after the crash. His ligaments were on the mend and his lungs didn't have their usual rasp, because his ganja supply was drying up for the winter. It's real seasonal. Back then, there wasn't as much hydroponic stuff going on. It was all bushweed. So in winter, it was just a dieback. And he didn't have much cash, so he wasn't buying it. We slept on Grant's freezing bus in Cecil's yard. Cecil was Grant's brother-in-law and a bit of a dickhead. And by pure bad luck, he was on the same flight as me to Sydney. "Oh, I love Sydney," Cecil told me. "But I've never seen the harbour from the plane. It's always been cloudy." Grant had tried to get me a bank statement for me to take with me as bullshit of my finances, but since his accident, he hadn't worked, and Grant had less money than I did, which was nothing. I waved off Grant, an absolute brother for sure, and got on the plane. Cecil was up front on the left of the plane. I was on the right. He kept looking back at me, giving me the knowing looks. "You're in deep shit, mate." My travelling life all rested on the next 30 minutes. As we descended through the sky over Sydney, the pilot spoke over the intercom. "Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to pass over the harbour of Sydney. Those on the left, you will get a spectacular view." Cecil turned round and gave me the thumbs up. At last, he would see the harbour. "Sorry, my apologies. Those on the right-hand side of the plane will have a spectacular view of the harbour." It was good. Because Cecil was just rubbing my nose in it. Because he didn't give a fuck about whether I made it into Australia. But now he couldn't see the harbour. And I was looking at it. I kept smiling at him. Going, oh, yeah, 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 it's good, man. Should have a... Yeah, yeah. It was a bit disturbing, though, that the pilot didn't know his right from his left. Things were looking up as I was looking down at this old familiar place that had kept me in money. I didn't want to go home and wake up from such a brilliant dream, only to be back where I started. It was a long walk through immigration. I hung back and let Cecil pass through. Dickhead. I was on the arse of my pants, a passport and $20 to my name. Guilt was welling up in me. Me in trouble. Like the time when I brushed with the law. I'd be trying to read my dad's face to see if they'd been round yet. I was thinking of good answers to the immigration questions when the guy just waved me through the invisible barrier. I could see the outside. I could have run. Thanks for listening, and hopefully, if I'm just reading from my journal, next time I do a podcast, I can make it happen. See you next time. Hopefully soon. Maybe I'll make it season 2 and call it the Journal Podcast or something. All right. Good night. And I'm actually down the beach on a Sunday morning, sat under a pandanus tree, listening to the ocean. And only sounds like white noise, doesn't it, on this tinny speaker. And just vibing. I just listened to the podcast before I posted it. And just vibing on what it was like just being by the ocean under a pandanus tree. With not much else to worry about. Give you all that time to focus in on nature, all the things around you. And it just relaxes you, just the ocean. It's like breathing. It's like the lungs of the ocean. Just pushing in. Pushing in. See you next time.